We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now that's what I call science. Hello, listeners. You're tuned into That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio and podcast show bringing you independent and interesting STEM, so that's science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, to you from Tasmania. This show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium news station. So head on over to edge.org.au for more information about them. I'd like to begin today's episode by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording, the Palo and Pakana. We're recording here on Luchuita, but as we are a podcast, we would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from where you, our listener, are tuning in from. On behalf of everyone here in the studio, I pay my respects to elders past and present. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Katia. And very excitingly, we are kicking off a plants mini-series. So I am going to pass on over to hear who our guest is in round one of plants.
Hi, Ollie. Thanks so much for the introduction. Like you said, I'm stoked to kick off the first episode of our Conservation of Tasmanian Plants mini-series, a three-part series where we talk to some incredible botanists in Tasmania. So being a plant scientist myself, the opportunity to platform people and the work being done in Tasmanian botany is really important to me. And I really think that more people should know about it. So that's why we're doing this. Today, I'm really excited to introduce Miguel De Salles as our first guest. Miguel is the curator for botany at the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery, and he works in the Tasmanian Herbarium. His role involves keeping tabs on all of the vascular plant species that are in Tasmania by publishing an annual plant census. The work he does is incredible, so I hope you're all keen to hear from him. Stay tuned for the next couple of episodes where we talk to someone from the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens and someone from the botany department at the University of Tasmania. So, Miguel, hello. Welcome to That's What I Call Science. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today. To start us off, tell us about yourself. Where are you from and a bit about your journey to where you are today?
Oh, wow. Well, I was originally born in Spain and spent the first 18 years of my life in there. And I came to Australia just in time to start uni. I was really interested actually in zoology when I came over. I always had an interest in plants, but I was mostly interested in zoology. But as soon as I started at uni, I just absolutely fell in love with botany. My start professionally was in aquatic botany, working on algae. But I've been working as a vascular plant curator on vascular plants, on land plants for the last 12 years or so.
Incredible. As you said, you are a curator at the Tasmania Museum and Art Gallery. Sounds like a very important role. Can you please describe what curation is, and are you the only curator in Tasmania?
No. So the herbarium's a small part of the Museum and Art Gallery, and we host the state's botanical collection. So we got a collection of about 300,000 plant species or so. These are plant pieces that have been pressed flat, dried, and then are stored, mounted on card. We also have massive collections of seaweeds, fungi, and lichens, and bryophytes, and so on, which are kept slightly differently. But I'm the curator of native vascular plants. I have a colleague, Matt, who specializes on weeds. He's the weeds curator. We also have a curator of cryptogams, and our boss, the head of herbarium, is a specialist on lichens as well. So I'm one of a few.
Why do we need to keep those samples and curate them? Why are they so important?
Well, without actually a piece of a plant that you're able to pull back out and have a look at, all you have left as evidence that something grew somewhere at a point in time is someone's word for it. And so when enough time passes and all you have is a name recorded in a book, for example, where someone says, this is the list of plants that I saw growing in blah, two things happen. Plant names change, and it might be really hard to track what exactly someone meant when they used a name that's long been not used for that plant. And also, you have to make a guess on what the expertise of that person is to identify that plant. After some time, when that person's no longer with us, you have no idea whether they were competent at identifying particular plants, especially plants that might be hard to identify, plants in groups that have a lot of close lookalikes and things like that. So having a physical sample of that plant stored in a herbarium means that at any point in time, you can come out and pull that out and have a look at and be absolutely sure of what it meant.
And speaking of names of plants, obviously across the world, many, many languages, we've got different names for things. Can you tell our listeners what is the system that we have for giving one plant species one name universally?
So it is we follow the Linnaean system, which Linnaeus was the first person who applied a systematic way of classifying plants, and he used the final piece is the binomial, which is the genus and the species, which are words that are Latinized, most often in Latin or in Greek, but they have to follow the grammatical rules of Latin. And for plants, we always, also you may have noticed, we have the genus and the species and an authority after it. There's often a person's name after it. And that's for a lot of cases, they happen very often, where two people have used the same name to apply to different plants at different points in time. We haven't always had the internet and this ability to pretty much out of our fingertips have all of the literature of the world available to us. Some time ago, if you were working, say, in Russia and another person was working in Australia and we're both working on a particular genus of plants, we might apply the same name to two completely unrelated plants independently. And so in those cases, there is a principle called nomenclatural priority. Whoever did it earliest takes priority. The other name becomes illegitimate. But in order to know which particular version of the name we're using, we put the authority after. So is it Linnaeus's version of the name or is it De Candolle's version of that name? Because they meant different things by it.
And I've heard that it's sort of a faux pas if you find a new species and named it after yourself, sort of work your name into there. But some people, especially in recent years, have been a bit creative with how they would class a new species. Maybe they'll put a favourite, an idol of theirs into the name. Do you by any chance have a favourite plant name that you think was particularly clever or you just enjoy the sound of?
Yes, when I worked on marine protists, there is a genus called Cafeteria.
Oh, awesome.
And I always had a chuckle when I came across one of them just because of the name.
They didn't find it in their cafeteria, did they? Is that right?
No, but they first thought about it while they were having a few drinks in the cafeteria.
Oh, awesome. That's so nice.
Why is taxonomy important and how do botanists identify and classify plants using herbarium specimens?
So I'll probably take it one step back and talk about what taxonomy is, because a lot of people probably don't have a very clear picture. Taxonomy is the study of taxa, and taxa are groups of organisms that that share traits in common, that have a common ancestry. And so a taxon could be a species or a genus, including all the species that descend from it, or a family that includes all the genera in that family, because our classifications are hierarchical, but it might also include a subspecies or a variety. So any of those ranks that we name, they are a taxon. And taxonomy is the study of where one ends and the next one starts and what we call a species. For example, a question that we get asked a lot is, in a herbarium, why do we have so many specimens of the same plant? Isn't one enough? Can't you just use the one to know what it is? And so then you can explain, well, if you have a specimen of a single plant, you can know a lot about an individual, but you don't know anything about the species because you don't know how much variation there is. So, for example, our floral emblem is the blue gum. And most people, when they think of blue gums, they think of a large tree with a single trunk, maybe in the parks around Hobart or in the gullies. But blue gums can be anything from a 1.5 metre high mallee that grows on the granite bluffs in Freycinet to a nearly 100 metre tall forest giant growing at the big giant blue gum grove near Lonavale in the Huon Valley. It was a whole grove of nearly 100 metre tall blue gums. And it spans every sort of possible shape and size in between. and it can have fruits which are single or in threes. They can be glaucous, which means covered in like a waxy bloom, or not. They can have leaves from sort of 15 centimeters long to nearly 75 centimeters long. Until you know all that, you can't start to talk about a species and where that species end and another species is, and you can't get an understanding of what the different species might be. So the study of taxonomy is the study of all the variation in the individuals, in populations, to try and understand how to classify them. But always with a proviso that classifications is just our way of wanting to fit the natural world into a system that we understand. And plants don't read books, so they're not always easy to classify. They don't know they're supposed to fit into a neat little box.
How dare they not behave by the rules and know exactly how they're meant to be? So when you're working in this field, what does an average day look like? What would you do at 9? What would you do at 2? Sort of, is every day the same or different?
No, incredibly different. That's one of the things that I like about especially in this job of curating. It's so varied because part of it is, and the title of curator implies the care of the collections, which is a very important part of it because we are custodians of these collections. Some of our specimens are 250 years old and we want them to last forever, essentially. So there's a large proportion of my work which is caring for the collection, maintaining the scientific currency and validity of the collection, so making sure that all the names that we have things stored as are the currently accepted names for those species so they don't sort of get lost in time, making sure that all incoming material is properly identified and that the data is properly checked before it's put away, but also working in taxonomy and writing flora treatments. For example, I'm the editor and one of the writers of the Flora of Tasmania Online, where we distill that sort of taxonomic knowledge we can gain from studying our collections into writing flora treatments, which are descriptions of all the plants in Tasmania and keys on how to identify them, which is translating that knowledge that we can get by studying the collection into something that people can use to identify plants.
Sounds like an incredibly varied job, and yeah, it's great work you do. So stick with us for part 2 as we dive deeper into Miguel's work as Tasmania's botany curator. You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and today we are talking all things plants. My name is Kati Bando and I'm joined by Ollie Dove along with our expert guest, Miguel DeCellis from the Tasmanian Herbarium. So you're currently a botanist, but you also have experience with dinoflagellates. Can you tell us a little bit about your work with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I studied plant science at the University of Tasmania, I ended up doing honours with Professor Gustav Hallegraaff, who was working in aquatic botany on toxic dinoflagellates specifically. And I ended up doing my PhD in the taxonomy of Tasmanian unarmored toxic dinoflagellates, a particular group of fish-killing dinoflagellates that, because they're unarmored, which means they don't have a shell of cellulose plates, which that cellulose plate shell is easy to preserve and look at under the microscope and contains a lot of useful characters for identifying species. But the species that don't have it were a lot harder to identify because they don't have that easily preserved shell. And so trying to use phylogenies from genetic data to inform what morphological characters present in the cells are actually useful for taxonomy and which ones weren't. I never set out to do that. It's just what I ended up doing. But I sort of became an accidental taxonomist, I suppose.
That sounds like a classic pathway in science. You start one thing and end up moving. Can I ask, what exactly is a dinoflagellate?
So the dinoflagellates are a group of algae, single-celled algae. They're really interesting because about half of them are heterotrophic. They are predatorial species that live by feeding on other algae in the water, and about half of them are able to photosynthesize. And so you almost, even though they are one single group, about half of them act as animals and about half of them act as plants, how we'd understand it, because half of them create their own food and half of them don't. But that, even that's a simplistic view, because even in the ones that can photosynthesize, some of them still eat other things as well, and some of them can eat other things when they're available, but can still, they can still complete their life cycle without supplementing their diet. And others are obligate, mixotrophs, they have to feed on other things in order to complete their life cycle.
What would make one or the other? Is there anything you can tell, sort of, if you got a dinoflagellate, you could tell, oh, this is going to be one of the types that does this because it's in a certain region?
Oh, no, because you can see the chloroplasts on them. So things like chloroplasts are pretty obvious in a cell when you look down a microscope because they're green.
Oh, interesting. So why are there these two types, though? Why have they not all got the ability to do both if that kind of sounds like it would be easier for them?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Even among the groups that contain chloroplasts, some of them, if you study the DNA of the chloroplasts, they're not related to each other. So dinoflagellates are one of those groups that they can eat other organisms and keep them in a food vacuole, continuing to photosynthesize. These are called kleptochloroplasts, stolen chloroplasts, and they run the whole gamut of possibilities from a kleptochloroplast that they keep for a few hours to a few weeks in a vacuole to completely undifferentiated sort of endosymbionts that are still almost exactly like the parent cell that was ingested, through to completely reduced chloroplasts where a lot of the functions of the endosymbiont have been transferred to the nucleus. So dinoflagellates look like they're able to eat prey and incorporate it, keep it as chloroplasts, and in many cases they've probably acquired chloroplasts and lost them and acquired them and lost them multiple times.
Whoa, and is it dinoflagellates that are related to bioluminescence?
Yes, one of the main species that causes bioluminescence in Tasmania is Noctiluca scintillans, which was for a long time considered to be a true dinoflagellate. I think nowadays they're considered to be a sister group to dinoflagellates, but very, very closely related. They also have two flagella. Dinoflagellates have two flagella, and they have a flagellum that, because they're a single cell, they move through the water by a flagellum that goes around their body in like a girdle, like a belt, and a flagellum that trails behind. So they use the one that trails behind to push themselves, and the one that goes in a girdle around their body, which is like a coil around their body. When they rotate that, they rotate the cell.
Wow. And, I mean, our listeners from here in Hobart will know of the bioluminescence and how incredible it is when you see it in the harbour. I fortunately saw it when I was on field work one time, and it looked like there were two Atlanteans fighting in the sea because the tide was so much and the tides were coming from two directions. Awesome.
Well, yeah, it seems like you've got lots of taxonomic experience, not just in plants, but also algae, single-celled algae. So can you share a memorable experience or discovery related to your work? Like, have you described a new species, perhaps?
Yeah, I've done a few. Probably in recent years, my favourite would be we were in an expedition funded by a Commonwealth program called Bush Blitz, which is a species discovery program run from Parks Australia. And they essentially organise all the logistics for us to go and do field work. And one year we were doing field work, this was probably 2015, doing field work in the Tarkine based out of Corunna. And we were lucky enough that Bush Blitz could afford to provide us with a helicopter that particular year. So we would flying out of the White River Road quarry on Brown's Plains and going pretty much anywhere we wanted to anywhere in the Tarkine. And one of the days we were at a place called the Harmon River, which is a tributary of the Wilson River that drains the eastern part of the Meredith Range. And we wanted to see, there's a large grove of Huon pines in there which has never been logged because they're disconnected from any other Huon pine population, so the loggers never found them. And it is an amazing place, but almost impossible to get to without a helicopter, which is good. but while walking up the Harmon River, it crosses a type of geology which occurs in quite a few places in Western Tasmania called serpentine. It's a rock type which breaks down to soils that are often very high in copper and nickel and a bit toxic to a lot of different plant species. And so it contains a lot of species that have evolved to tolerate those conditions that don't occur anywhere else. And so they're called endemisms, species that are endemic or only grow in those particular areas. And while crossing this serpentine, I found a violet that was growing on the riverbanks. I thought, oh, that looks a bit odd. So I picked it up, took it, made it into a specimen. And when we got back to the lab trying to identify them, they always stood out. And if I follow the keys in the existing floras, a key is sort of like a choose your own adventure to end up with a plant name. You know, are the flowers yellow or red, or do the leaves come in threes or twos? Are they opposite or alternate? Things like that until you finally get a name. And with this one, you could follow the key straight away and get a name, and the name made no sense because this plant didn't look like that species. So you always know when you get a straightforward path through the key to a name that makes no sense that there's something interesting going on. And so that turned out to be a new species, which was endemic only to serpentine areas in western Tasmania and nowhere else. And it looks like it grows on every single outcrop of serpentine through the west coast. And it's abundant. It's really, really common and really showy, but somehow it had just gone... It had gone undetected. And I think one of the reasons was that if you followed the key, it gave you a name. And so when I went through the boxes of that species in the collection, I actually found several specimens of this new species, all of which were annotated as growing on serpentine, that people had probably just gone through the key and said, all right, it doesn't look much like it, but I'll put that name on it anyway and file it away. So nobody had realized it was a new species.
Wow, that's incredible. So what name is it?
It's called Viola serpentinicola, which means lover of serpentine. And that thing of actually finding it already in the collections, the vast majority of species we discover today already are in collections. People have seen them, have collected them, and they just either haven't had the expertise or for whatever reason haven't realized that this thing is a different species and undescribed. And so it's just gone back in the collection with another name, and there it sits sometimes for decades, 100 years or more, until somebody comes through who's maybe doing a review of every single species in that group or whatever and realizes that this thing is different when compared to everything else.
Yeah, that just shows how important it is to have that record in the herbaria.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So stick with us, listeners, for part three as we continue chatting to Miguel about his work involving the conservation of Tasmanian plants.
If you're enjoying the show today, make sure you check us out on Instagram or Twitter at ThatScienceTaz, on our website thatsciencetaz.org, or on Facebook at That's What I Call Science.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science, and we are talking all things plants in our part one of our Conservation of Tasmanian Plants mini-series. My name is Katu Bando, and I'm joined with Ollie Dove, along with our expert guest, Miguel De Salis, from the Tasmanian Herbarium. So, Miguel, I've noticed you're on iNaturalist a lot. Would you care to tell the audience what iNaturalist is and your role as a curator on the site?
Sure. iNaturalist is a citizen science platform. It's, I guess my partner likes to describe it as Facebook for plant nerds, although it's for much more than plants. iNaturalist is a social network of people uploading observations of plants and animals and fungi and other living organisms and sharing knowledge of the natural world, having people who might have the expertise giving you proper identifications and talking about its aim, I think, is to bring people closer to the natural world by helping them to understand it better. But it is a really good tool because iNaturalist observations usually come with a photo and usually come with a GPS spot and a point in time. So they're almost, they're about as good as it comes for an observation that doesn't have a physical specimen attached to it, because you can see, you can get so much information out of that, the photo and the place and the time.
Do you need to be a plant expert to use iNaturalist?
No, absolutely not. No. Anyone can have an iNaturalist account. It is a social media, essentially, and anybody can upload observations of organisms. And I use it a lot. Well, I mean, I use it for myself because I'm interested in it and I like making observations of plants, but also because as a botanist working in Tasmania, you get to see a lot of people's... It's like having extra pairs of eyes everywhere. And so you start to see a lot of stuff that you're physically not able to unfold yourself into 20 different places, you know, and be in 20 different places at once. So seeing every day what people are uploading has already resulted in several occasions where people have put a picture up of something that we go say, oh, wow, what is that? We need to go and have a look at it and go and find something new or interesting. There was a new subspecies of a dusty miller species that was found in the northwest coast a couple of years ago. And that was just purely through an iNaturalist observation that somebody put it up. And I realized I had seen that before in Victoria, but it wasn't supposed to be present in Tasmania. And so I just drove up there and had a look, collected some specimens. And that was purely out of somebody just using that platform how it's intended.
That's awesome. And it sounds like a really fun thing that you can do when you're just going for a hike, just not just take photos for yourself, but also then help the field of plant science.
So you are the author of the Census of Tasmanian Vascular Plants year to year. Do you want to just give us a little overview of that? And if there's sort of any sort of major changes you've seen since doing that initiative?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, with changes, every single year, every single edition has a bunch of changes of plant names because we try and keep abreast of the nomenclature changes around the world and all the ones that affect all of our plants. So the census is a publication that tracks not only what we think is the correct name for every plant that grows in the wild in Tasmania, but also every name that has ever been applied to that plant in the literature in the past. So if you're trying, I was mentioning earlier about coming across an old name in an old publication and it being difficult to find what the name might apply to. So we try and solve that problem. And also we try and account for every plant that has ever been mentioned in a book in Tasmania, whether we still consider it a part of the flora or not. Because many times people have said that a plant grows in Tasmania, say, in a book. But just because they say it doesn't mean it does. In many cases, we have absolutely no evidence that it does. So the census also tries to account for all of that and for us to say, we think, yes, we think this plant grows here. No, we think this one doesn't. We think this one's introduced and common. We think this one has maybe a few little populations, things like that.
Fantastic. And thank you so much for joining us today. I did my master's in taxonomy and biodiversity at the Natural History Museum, so it was like lovely to hear about taxonomy again and dip back into it. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to That's What I Call Science. We love bringing you STEM-related content and hope you enjoyed the show. If you loved the show today, you can get in touch with us by searching That's What I Call Science or That Science Taz on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. My name is Ollie Dove, and I'd like to extend a huge thank you to my co-host, Katia, and our expert guest, Miguel DeSalis. Hope you all have a wonderful week. This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. That's What I Call Science is brought to your station and across the nation via the Community Radio Network. You can find the show at all major podcast streaming services and find out more about us from our social media channels. Make sure you like and subscribe to keep up with all the exciting science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine research in Lutruwita, Tasmania. This show is supported and strengthened by Edge Radio, so head over to edgeradio.org.au for more information about them. Thanks for tuning in today, and may your week be STEM-tastic.